We're looking at the legacy of slavery and racism in our country and the concept of atonement and paying reparations for Black Americans. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. And to inform our discussion, we'll first learn about projects of reconciliation and social justice underway around the globe. Please be aware that this hour's conversation is sensitive, painful. It could be triggering, so please take care. What questions do you have about reconciliation efforts in other countries after conflicts? How could America come to truth and reconciliation for generations of injustices, from slavery to lynchings to Jim Crow laws to redlining? Join in 800-642-1234 at any point. Ereshni Naidu Silverman is Senior Director for the Global Transitional Justice Initiative at the International Coalition of Sites of Conscience based in New York. Her work has included designing programs in post-conflict areas such as South Africa, Liberia, Sierra Leone, Sri Lanka, and Colombia. Ereshni, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate, and thank you for having me.
Well, take us back to your upbringing in South Africa during the apartheid regime. Can you tell us what it was like?
So I grew up in a working class family. I'm of Indian descent. And so I grew up predominantly in an Indian community, and that's because we had the Group Areas Act, which is similar to redlining here. And it was essentially the ghettoization of people of color. Growing up, because we had public television services, we hardly ever saw what was happening on television. However, there's a few examples that I can share with you where I experienced direct discrimination and racism. And that was mainly around when I was a kid. I saw it happening, but I didn't know exactly what it was. So, for example, we would go as a family to the beach, but we were not allowed to go into the water. So we would have to sit in the car and look out onto the sea, but because we were not allowed on the public beaches as people of color. Another incident that sticks with me is when I was a kid and we couldn't vacation in South Africa. Because most of the amenities were not for people of color. So we would travel outside of South Africa to the independent states like Swaziland and Lesotho. And traveling out, I probably was around 7 or so. And my dad stopped at a gas station and we were getting gas and I needed to go to the bathroom. And we asked the attendant if we could have the keys to the bathroom, and he said no, it was for white people only. And I remember clearly my dad had like put in a few cents of gas, and he stopped and we left and we went to another station.
Were you allowed to use the restroom at another station?
We had to drive quite a while after that before I got to another station. The other thing was that we, for example, had pass laws in South Africa. So all Black South Africans, African South Africans, had to carry a pass ID card if they were going to travel outside of the area in which they lived. So lots of the domestic workers, for example, would have to leave their homes to work in the cities. And there were this group of Black men who were employed by the police, but were used to enforce the pass laws. And I remember clearly the neighbors sharing this information. They were called blackjacks and would share this information that the blackjacks are coming. And the domestic workers would have to hide in like cupboards, under the bed, because they didn't want to get arrested. So these are just some of the examples. But I think what was the most upsetting for me later on when I realized it in my teenage years was that I wasn't able to interact with my fellow South Africans. So the Black people that I knew at the time as a kid was domestic workers. And the white people that I knew at that time were people that worked in stores and had positions of power. And I think one of the things for me is that it takes so many generations to get over the idea of white supremacy and the idea of being less, because it becomes so entrenched in your consciousness that even when I went to university, I remember in my first few months of being in university, I was our cohort knew at that time when we were at university that there needed to be change and change wasn't coming soon. And it was just after Mandela was released from prison.
Nelson
And
Mandela.
yes. And I recall just being kind of afraid even to interact with white colleagues or even white professors, where we looked at them with absolute like awe and respect and that kind of thing. And so it was unlearning lots of this discrimination that had become entrenched, even though I wasn't of the generation of my grandparents, for example, who basically looked up at white people. So that's kind of in a nutshell what it was.
If you're just joining us, we're discussing how communities can reconcile after conflicts, generations of racism. Our guide is Ereshni Naidu Silverman from the International Coalition of Sites of Conscience. How do you think America could reconcile its racist past? What do you think of the process should look like? We're at 800-642-1234. Ereshni, how did anti-apartheid political leader Nelson Mandela be part of the negotiation process to end apartheid in South Africa in the early 90s?
Mandela was always a figure that was revered. And at that time, so as I said, everybody lived in different townships, people of color. And at that time, towards the late 80s, early 90s, our black townships, when I say black, I'm referring to Africans, and that's how people were designated, just to clarify. We had white South Africans, we had African South Africans, Indian South Africans, and colored South Africans who were biracial people. And so, but Mandela and our townships were on fire. Like people were protesting. It was very similar to what we've been seeing in the past few months here, where people are angry, tired of the oppression and discrimination, and the only way they can show this anger is to take to the streets. And that's what we were seeing in all of our townships. So our townships were essentially on fire. Lots of young people were getting killed. And at that time, they decided that the politicians decided this was the time for the end of apartheid. And one of the things I also want to note is that at that time it was President F.W. de Klerk who, together with Nelson Mandela, won the Peace Prize. However, at that time, and even now, F.W. de Klerk still says that he didn't think apartheid was wrong morally, but he saw it as a failed political project.
We have to pause there as we explore South Africa, truth and reconciliation with Ereshni Naidu Silverman from the International Coalition of Sites of Conscience. She leads the Global Transitional Justice Initiative. Were your ancestors involved in American slavery? How do you think our country could make amends today? Are you involved in a community organization that seeks to resolve conflicts? Join in with your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Back in a moment on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about the history of racial terror and trauma and what can be learned from truth and reconciliation work around the globe. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Please be aware that this conversation is bringing up sensitive and painful topics, so please take care as we spend this hour together. The Global Transitional Justice Initiative is at work in 17 countries, dozens of projects to document past human rights atrocities and struggles for justice and work to make sure that they don't happen again. What do you want to know about programs in South Africa, in Liberia, Sri Lanka, Colombia? Are you involved in a project that works to bring truth and understanding locally or globally? Tell us about your efforts to bring about change. 800-642-1234. Ereshni Naidu Silverman is from the International Coalition of Sites of Conscience, and she stays with us. Ereshni, after apartheid was dismantled, South Africa established a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. What was the aim there?
The goal of the commission was to uncover some of the truths about the past, looking at some of the root causes for apartheid, and also provide a platform for victims to share their experiences and provide some kind of justice and redress for them.
When you look at the commission and how it was working, what was good about the process and where did it fall short?
So South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation is often celebrated around the world, and lots of truth commissions are based on the South African Truth Commission. The one thing that the South African Truth Commission did was that it focused on uncovering lots of the silences and denial about what happened in the past, because lots of South Africans, white South Africans particularly, claimed that they didn't know, so they couldn't do anything. So it called out lots of the bystanders.
And this is thousands of people testifying about life during apartheid.
Yes. So it allowed that space to be open to break down the myths about the past and allow for Black South Africans to be reintegrated into South African society. One of the shortcomings, a few shortcomings of the process, was that as part of the peace negotiations, the government of South Africa agreed that there would be an amnesty clause, so perpetrators could come forward and testify in exchange for amnesty. And what we saw over and over again was that Black South Africans bent over backwards to forgive and to listen with humility about what happened to their loved ones. So we heard cases of people who were tortured, who were kidnapped, loved ones who went missing. And I'm not going to go into the horrific details. There's the report that can be read. But lots of perpetrators came forward testifying and showed very little remorse, and they got amnesty for their participation in the Truth Commission. And victims up to today are still waiting for reparations, for example.
And what were those reparations? What was offered to the victims of apartheid through the process?
So the Truth Commission made a holistic set of recommendations, which they hoped were going to be implemented by the South African government. So some of it was compensation for individual families, and that was a recommendation, I think, for a grant, monthly grant. Eventually, victims got paid approximately $20,000, I would say.
In a lump sum?
Yeah, and that was it. There was recommendations for symbolic reparations, the renaming of streets, memorialization projects, community reparations, which would look at increased access to services for people of color, education, improved education, because apartheid affected all aspects of life. And there were specific laws as well that provided different kind of benefits for different race groups. So these were the recommendations. Apart from that, they also recommended that business and corporate should be held accountable for benefiting from apartheid. And that some of the funds that were that came from this could be used to pay reparations for families. Right now, there's still survivors that are, and the other thing is that the South African Truth Commission focused on bodily harms. So we didn't focus on the day-to-day socioeconomic violations. And that was one of the biggest shortcomings, because now we see South Africa, there's still protests, people are still taking to the streets because the socioeconomic gap has not closed. So while there's policies in place in terms of practices, white South Africans still benefit to a large degree. There is a growing middle class, but the majority of black South Africans remain in poverty. And that's part of the shortcoming of the Truth Commission, because they focused on human rights violations that were related only to the body and not to socioeconomic crimes and the day-to-day effects of apartheid.
We're talking with Areshni Naidu Silverman, Senior Director for the Global Transitional Justice Initiative at the International Coalition of Sites of Conscience, looking at this question after conflicts, how do people solve their differences? Examining this question in different parts of the globe, looking at South Africa right now, and you can join in. Are you involved in a community organization that seeks to resolve conflicts? What are you doing? How are you trying to bring peace? We're at 800-642-1234. Let's move out of South Africa now and look at other countries that have you worked in, Liberia, Sierra Leone, Sri Lanka. How do the processes in other countries reflect what you saw in South Africa or deviate?
I think just to start, when a truth commission process or a transitional justice process more broadly is announced, there's lots of expectations. And in most cases, any transitional justice process is not perfect, and it's not going to meet the needs of everybody, because survivors in themselves are not a homogenous group, and so they also have different needs. And there's time limitations on a transitional justice process. So, for example, it's time, but it's also resources. So the one country that, for example, has deviated slightly, which has been great, and the report just was released earlier in June, was Tunisia, which focused on economic crimes. So moving away from the South African model to look at how economic crimes related to nepotism, fraud, corruption had affected Tunisians on a day-to-day basis. In Sierra Leone, for example, because many of the violations were focused on basically, people were amputated during the war, and that was part of the violation. So lots of the recommendations focused on addressing people with needs for people with disabilities, which was also groundbreaking because not too many commissions have focused on that. And they also focused on sexual and gender-based violations.
When these commissions form in these countries, who do they recruit to sit on the commission and guide its work?
So generally, a commission comes into is put into place either through a law from parliament, a presidential declaration, a peace agreement, or through the UN. And the mandates of the policy, the legal framework that guides it will basically put in guidelines and recommendations for who the commissioners should be, what should be the representation, that kind of thing. So sometimes there's an open call, sometimes there's nominations for commissions. And in all of this, when we're looking at particularly how to how representative commissioners should be, the question is also how independent they are. Because there's commissions like in Sri Lanka, for example, where there's been commissions and they were put in place by the president, but they were not independent. So, and then, and if, for example, in Sri Lanka, just before this new dispensation, there were also requests, if there was going to be a truth commission process, to have international commissioners. Sierra Leone, for example, did that, where they had some international commissioners on the commission. So that's also a debate, whether you use only national or whether you use international commissioners as well, to ensure that there's some kind of legitimacy of the process.
Go ahead.
No, so basically it's the framework, the legal framework that would guide what the commissioners what the commission should look like.
We're talking with Areshni Naidu Silverman from the International Coalition of Sites of Conscience, and you can join in. What do you want to say about reparations or reconciliation? What do you think is the best path forward? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. We'll pick this up after a news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're talking this hour about truth and reconciliation and how to take steps to repair generations of racial oppression in the U.S., informed by work we're learning about around the globe. Please bear in mind, this is a sensitive and difficult conversation here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A pair of fellows at the think tank Brookings argued in favor of reparations for Black Americans in a policy paper they published in April. Here are a couple lines from it. Slavery enriched white slave owners and their descendants, and it fueled the country's economy while suppressing wealth building for the enslaved. The United States has yet to compensate descendants of enslaved Black Americans for their labor, end quote. How do you view reparations for African Americans? Join in any point, 800-642-1234. Areshni Naidu Silverman is Senior Director for the Global Transitional Justice Initiative at the International Coalition of Sites of Conscience, and she stays with us. Areshni, take us to the United States, if you will, and coming from South Africa and seeing the U.S. with fresh eyes, how have you viewed America's racial dynamic and the sensitivities here with the presence of slavery through the ages?
Thanks, Kate. When I first moved to the U.S., I was and this was many years ago, I was immediately able to see racism. I lived at that time in a predominantly Black community, and you could already see how disadvantaged that community was. And if you moved a few blocks down the street, which was a different neighborhood, you could see the difference because it was a predominantly white community. So coming from South Africa, I think I already come with a lens to view race and racism. And so I was able to see it immediately. I think the country, whether it was imperialism, to slavery, Jim Crow, and just broader practices of segregation and discrimination. It's clear that it affects here all aspects of life here as well. And now we see this through the protests and the calls for justice on the street, because there has been no redress. African Americans still live on the margins of society here, so they have different access to services, different access to justice, if any. And we've seen that again in the calls for institutional transformation. So racism is inherent in the society, and it's actually been the foundation of the United States. Like, the United States was founded through slavery. And because it hasn't been addressed, it's been left to fester over many generations. And I think now is the time we see with people taking to the streets that now is the time for something to be done to bring African Americans back into the citizenry and ensure that there's equal rights for all Americans.
Arashni, if you were going to design a reconciliation process for the U.S., what would it look like?
Unfortunately, I don't have an answer to that specifically. But I think the great thing about transitional justice is that it's constantly evolving, and it's a non-prescriptive process that should ideally be very context specific. So we can draw lessons from other contexts for the US, but it needs to be specifically US. And then we have other questions, like should this be a national process? Or should it be, given how big the US is, and if we're talking about context specificity, should it be at a state level where different states hold hearings, for example, as a like Truth Commission hearings, and that feeds into a national narrative and the national government, for example, supports it through a bill and through funding? The one example that I can draw on right now is currently Maryland is holding a lynching commission.
A lynching truth and reconciliation commission, yes.
Yes. And so they have, and it was, the bill was approved bipartisanly. So that was also interesting to see that both sides had approved it. And right now they're working on a county level to do different memorialization projects for victims of lynching. However, they, given that the bill is so broad, they can also look at some of the root causes of lynching, so going back as far as slavery. So I think the question is, firstly, we need an enabling bill. We need somebody to support that bill and for it to be pushed through Congress. And then we need to decide what truth commissions, whether a truth commission would happen, for starters. And in my view, that's necessary because then we rewrite the narratives and it becomes a more inclusive narrative that focuses more on human rights in the country. And then it's the question of justice. Like, what period are we looking at? Are we going to go as far back as First Nations, or are we going to look at slavery or Jim Crow, or are we only going to look at current police brutality? And just to say, we can look at all of these things, and there's different options. So for example, right now in Colombia, there is a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and that's going to focus specifically on truth-telling and collecting people's testimonies, as well as providing redress for victims. But there's also another commission that's going to look specifically at accountability and justice issues. So there's different models that we can draw on for the U.S.
And we're exploring how countries can reconcile after conflicts. Our guide is Arashni Naidu Silverman from the International Coalition of Sites of Conscience. You can join in 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Logan now in Green Bay. Hi, Logan.
Hi. Thank you. Coincidence. I have the same last name as Arashni. Hi. Was born in South Africa, and I felt the pain of apartheid. And comparing South Africa to the United States is much more complex. Hence, it's going to take a lot of time to heal and have a society that's equal in all respects. I enjoyed living in South Africa, although I had to follow the rules of apartheid. My dad was of Indian descent, and my mom was of Irish descent, and we got along very well with all the relatives, and most of my relatives were biracial. And I used to express my views on apartheid through the newspapers, And once two men from the secret police came, and it was an implicit threat that I stopped writing. But they used another story that I was involved in burning a black university. Actually, the blacks burnt it because they felt that it was so segregated and it wasn't good for education. So Fania left the country, married somebody from the United States, and when she came to South Africa, lots of people stared at her and kind of encouraged the relationship.
Logan, I want to jump in here and allow Areshni to respond to your story and the situations that you found yourself in. Areshni, talking there about limited press freedoms, what was that like?
I remember clearly, for example, that my dad was a printer, and he would print in basically with lights out. He would print pamphlets and newsletters, things like that, for the ANC at that time. So even something as basic as that, people were prevented from doing it. I think even though, and Logan, it's lovely to hear from a fellow South African, just to say, but also Logan's experience is the story of so many South Africans. I've got friends and colleagues that have had similar experiences where they've been able to speak, where they were speaking out against apartheid and were framed for whether it was petty crimes or whether it was bigger crimes, were framed for these things because they were speaking out about the government. So, and that's one of the indicators, I guess, is the amount of freedom that the press has, the indicators for democracy. And right now, I think if we had to draw that parallel to the US, we hear so much about fake news, and it's difficult to figure out where we're going to get our news from, what's the truth. And that's why I think a process like this will also allow us to look at the role of the media in the transitional justice processes, because in South Africa, the media played a very significant role in telling the stories of South Africans.
What do you see here in the U.S.?
In terms of
media and the press. Mm-hmm.
I think everything right now, we see everything is so politicized in the U.S. There's so much division and there's so much of healing that's needed. I mean, with the coronavirus, for example, we're still looking at how face masks are being politicized. So in the U.S., I think as much as there's different media for a different audience, we're not always getting the truth or the full facts. And that's highly problematic. However, the mediating point issue for this is that we now have, for example, cameras on our phones and social media. So there's other truths that we are able to expose and that we are able to see in through via social media. So I think that's been helpful. However, the whole question of fake news is constantly brought up, and people are constantly, even when we have evidence on camera of a black man being brutalized and killed.
We have to pause there with Areshni Naidu Silverman on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. The death of George Floyd at the hands of a white police officer and the pandemic's racial disparities, they've put historic inequalities of black Americans into sharper focus. There are calls that it's long overdue for reparations to the descendants of enslaved black Americans and to pay for anti-black policies traced back to slavery. This is difficult, possibly a triggering discussion, so please be aware of that. Could reparations help heal our nation? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Areshni Naidu Silverman is with the New York-based International Coalition of Sites of Conscience, and she stays with us. Let's take another call now. Martha is with us from Menominee. Hi, Martha.
Hi, good morning, Kate. Thank you so much for doing this. You've been doing some wonderful shows lately on these topics, so keep up the good work.
Thank you, Martha.
My comment is that to get to truth and reconciliation, we need some structural changes, and we need to do this politically, because this is going to come through governmental laws and acts enforced to establish this. So my two suggestions would be, number one, to abolish the Electoral College, because that was established as a compromise with the slave states. So we need to get rid of that. And number two, we need to give Washington, D.C. congressional representation. That would put two senators and however many Congress people representing the District of Columbia, which is a largely black populated city. And if we did these two things, I think we would start to see laws and programs put in place that would allow these truth and reconciliation and reparation laws to come to fruition. And I'd like to get your guest's take on that.
Martha, thank you. Arashni?
I fully agree with Martha that we need structural changes, and we need it to political will to put any transitional justice process into place. The reality is that transitional justice is a political process. However, it relies on political will from the beginning right up to the end, because it's a process. As much as a truth commission, for example, would be time sensitive. The implementation of recommendations, for example, depends on political will, unless there's a separate institution that's going to be set up. And just to say that I'm not going to comment on the Electoral College and congressional representation in DC, but just to go back to Martha's point, is that we keep on hearing, I mean, we hear often in the US that there isn't a problem of race. Between 1870 and 2018, of 1,974 members in Senate, only 10 of them were African Americans. And I think it's clear to say that we cannot, 10 people cannot be representative of an entire group of people. So that needs to be changed as well. But conversely, I think a transitional justice process will be able to also make structural changes. So if we had to look at institutional transformation, which is one of the pillars of transitional justice, it would be changes to the judiciary, reforming all of the security sector, looking at these issues that Martha raised. So that could be encompassed into part of a transitional justice process.
Let's bring in Carl in Madison with thoughts now. Hi, Carl.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm intrigued by the potential for a truth and reconciliation process of the U.S. But one thing that I'm pretty confused about, I assume that any future truth and reconciliation process would be hotly contested and delegitimized by a significant portion of the public, politicians, media, that don't agree with it. So, assuming that possibility, how do you go about a process that has an impact?
Arashni?
I agree. I think we're going to see lots of contestation, but all transitional justice processes are contested because there's people that always feel that there shouldn't be equality. But I think part of it is about moral imperative of ensuring that all citizens in a country have equality and are able to have the same accesses to different privileges and things like justice, for example. Go ahead.
When a commission is set up, and to Carl's point here about getting the buy-in, having people on the same page, supporting the process, how binding the recommendations and rulings of the commission and how much power that commission has in the reconciliation process, how can that affect the way people view that work?
Yeah, unfortunately, The Truth Commission recommendations are not binding. Often there's institutions that are set up to implement Truth Commission recommendations. They're independent, and they will go ahead and implement some of the recommendations. But as I said, it requires political will along the way. I think what's very heartening at this moment in time is that we've seen so many youth take to the street, very diverse of different races. And so I think more and more there's a groundswell towards ensuring equality for everybody. And I think if more and more of those voices are heard and come out, we would be able to have a significant mass of people that would support the process. There's always spoilers to any peace process, and that should be expected. But I don't believe that we can stand on the sidelines and say it's going to be contested and we cannot move forward with this. We need to try and see what happens and actually be prepared to address those naysayers and spoilers.
We're talking about reconciliation with Ereshni Naidu-Silverman from the International Coalition of Sites of Conscience. Ereshni, how could white Americans benefit from a reconciliation process?
I think we've heard it so clearly on the streets, Kate, that if there's no justice, there's no peace. And so white Americans will benefit in the sense that there would be equality and justice for all. But also, if there's a denial of justice and rights for one part of a population, it undermines the legitimacy of an entire system more broadly. And in South Africa, we have this phrase. It's called Ubuntu, and it means I am because of you. So because you recognize my humanity, I'm able to be human. And I think that goes both ways, right? If white Americans are dehumanized, they will constantly live in this space of being vilified and dehumanized. And it's vice versa as well. So I think it's also a moral obligation, and it talks to our values. So and to sustainable peace, because currently what we're seeing on the streets, the protests, the anger, it's not going to end. Even if it does end at any time soon, we're still going to see waves of it recurring. And we've seen this throughout the history of the U.S. So the question is, do we want sustainable peace? And what's our moral obligation?
We only have a few seconds left. What do you say to the denial, to Americans who say, I didn't do this, why should I pay? It's not something that has been in my generation.
I've heard that very often in my work, and I would like to say that it's about benefit and it's about privilege. As much as people may not have had families who were slave owners, they may have came here as generations of very impoverished people from Europe, but they have access and they have the privilege of that access, which many people of color in the U.S. and Black Americans do not have. The one thing I would like to also end with is that yesterday I had the privilege of being in a conversation with a hereditary chief.
And we only have a few seconds left.
Full late. And he said, we're all one human family born from the same pot of blood. To recognize oneness, the future becomes clear.
Ereshni, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Kate.
Ereshni Naidu-Silverman, Senior Director at the International Coalition of Sites of Conscience. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and this is the Ideas Network.